All right, so welcome. So this month we've been focusing on the what's called the Satipatthana Sutta. So if you're coming in the middle of this series, the Satipatthana is also called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And this is one of the most critical, important suttas in our tradition because it establishes really the meditative practice. But for a particular reason, you know, it's not just to feel calm or to feel a sense of well-being. Those are in some ways side effects. The Satipatthana, or the Four Foundations, is really focused on this direct path toward awakening. And so the first week we explored some of the languaging around that. And one way to understand this direct path to awakening is through understanding the sense of self, this assumption that there's a solid me, a solid sense of who I am that has emotions, that has feelings, that has actions, and also how that's projected outward into other people. There's also these solid bits of self, pieces of self, points of reference. So there's kind of a functionality to this sense of self. You know, someone calls your the roll call and you raise your name, your hand when you hear your name. Okay, I'm here. There's a sense of me doing my job, my work, navigating through life. So it's a navigational self that helps us get through the day. But if we just stay at that level, if we just assume that's the complete picture, there's nothing else beyond this limited sense of me, it actually ties us into these deep patterns of suffering. And this is really the problem that the Buddha decided to try to solve and solve for himself and offered this lineage, this tradition as a way to do that. And so this sutta is a very direct way to explore that, particularly around understanding the sense of self. To go ahead beyond the Buddhist time to one of the famous Zen teachers, Dogen, who first brought Soto Zen to Japan, one of his famous quotes is that to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this non-trace, this no trace, continues endlessly. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. Okay, so these words, for me, really resonate with this sutta, looking at the sutta as a way to deconstruct this assumption of self. You know, the different foundations, there's a foundation of the body, breath, body sensation, that we explored the first 2 weeks, especially the last week, and how this sense of self really forms around that sense of identity in our bodies. The sense of my body is attractive or unattractive. This whole story that we come up around that. And learning to see that's just an overlay to the actual physical experience of being in a body. And there's a freedom when we see that. We realize we still have this body to care for, but it doesn't define who we are as a person. As this, there's something else that defines that. Now the structure of the four foundations starts with the body, and I think it's very helpful to start with that because it provides this place of grounding, this point of reference that connects us right into the present moment. Because the body is very, very physical, very grounded. Usually we're grounding from being lost in concept, being lost in idea. Coming back into the body gives us this present moment reference point. And also by looking at it from a particular way of seeing how it doesn't contain inherently who we are, it starts to clean up our relationship to our body. So it's not so enmeshed with our identification. We see that the body is not us. See, if we can observe something, if we can see it, we can sense the breath, the body sensation. It means we're not of that that same thing. We can't observe something and still be within it. There's a sense of witnessing, a sense of a little bit of being outside of it to be able to be far enough away to see it. So we're trying to see where we are. We see our body, the sensations in our body, we see that those are always changing. They're not a reliable place of reference. And the body also becomes a nice template as we go into the second and third foundations of Vedana or feeling tone, and also mind states or consciousness. It's a template because we learn how to first have this very open awareness, or attention that's not subject to our preferences, our judgment. We see it very cleanly, and we can, through that we start to naturally untie our identification with it. So tonight we're going to explore the second and the third foundations. Now in these foundations, and we particularly start to look at the sense of reactivity that we carry, the sense of emotionality, the sense of thoughts and concepts, ideas of who we are. And for me, that really starts to starts to dissolve this belief in the sense of self when we really open to it. Simply by observing it. You know, just by observing the sense of who we are in these different mind states, we see that it really is more empty than we take it to be. So the second foundation of mindfulness, Vedana. So Vedana is often translated as feeling or feeling tone, and that can be a little misleading. Because feeling, we have this idea of emotionality, of a sense of, you know, being sad or happy or angry. But it's not about emotion. It's really this almost fundamental component to experience. And through our practice, and we start to be able to see the quality of Vedana in every moment of experience. Now, when I say experience, we're not talking about like I went to Disneyland and had a great experience, kind of a real broad sense of experience. It's really this moment by moment contact with one of the sense gates. Okay, so we have six sense gates. We have smelling, we have tasting, we have seeing, hearing, feeling, and also thought. Okay, so anytime that you hear something or smell something, see something, in that moment of contact, there's inherent in that a quality of Vedana, of being pleasant, being unpleasant, or being either pleasant or unpleasant. So it's the Buddha really looked at his mind in a very, very clear, microscopic way and saw how things built upon each other. So it's a very sophisticated, very elegant system as we start to open to it. Now the five senses that we're usually used to also has the addition of thought. I think that's very interesting. That the Buddha looked at thought as being another sense gate, that we can have an idea come up, and he looked at it as the same as hearing a sound, as seeing a sight, as having a smell arise in our consciousness. Because from that moment of contact, there's this whole mechanism that gets driven from that. Vedana also arises before our normal states of reactivity, our normal concepts, boredom, desire, any emotions. Those are all elaborations from this point of Vedana. And so it's often missed. It's kind of a subtle quality of experience that you have to really train yourself to look for it and get a sense of that. It's always present, but it happens so quickly that the contact happens, Vedana happens, and then the whole reactivity happens from that. Right? Usually the reactivity is what we get focused on, that we take, that's what I really am interested in. You know, sometimes I wish I had be able to show like an AV or a film or something. Because have you ever seen those ice crystals, those time-lapse photography of ice crystal forming? How it starts with just this little dot, and then slowly it starts to build and build and build and become more and more elaborate. Right, so I actually encourage you to take a look at on YouTube for one of those ice crystal formation or snowflake formation. So I thought that was a nice analogy for the process of Vedana and what comes after that. That there's a little moment of contact, a little point of contact. It's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And from that point, we build this whole ice crystal structure, you know, bit by bit, and gets more and more elaborate. And there's a moment when it starts, and there's a moment when it keeps elaborating. And so it's a very beautiful structure if you've ever looked at those. So this elaborate ice crystal structure is our thoughts, our emotions, our self-beliefs, and our sense of self, how we take ourselves to be, who we are. And so sometimes those ice crystals, we enjoy it. You know, we have this really elaborate crystal, and we're lost in this sense of fantasy or this sense of self-concept that is very pleasant. And sometimes it's not so pleasant. You know, the Vedana is unpleasant, and it creates this whole structure of self-deprecating thoughts, of failure, of worry, anxiety. And particularly the pleasant and unpleasant tend to really create the crystals. The neutral quality of life tends to be, we tend to kind of skim over that, at least at first. I think as our practice deepens, we start to really appreciate the neutral quality. Because when there's a neutral, when we make contact with something and there's just a neutral relationship to it, it's not pleasant or unpleasant, there's more of a natural abiding with that. As we practice, we start to naturally untie some of these deep patterns of reactivity that we live with. And in that untying of those patterns, we find that things become more pleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant, more neutral. Not in a way of being kind of bland or without monochrome, without any kind of color. But it's actually, there's this richness because it's not being driven by our reactivity. So we're able to much more abide with that present moment's experience. Now, just like the ice crystal, it eventually melts. Right? So this elaboration that comes from this point of Vedana eventually dissolves into something else. Another ice crystal arises. And so we go on and on in the cycle of being born and fading away. This is explored very clearly in the dependent origination, the circle of dependent origination. So if you look at Vedana, this feeling tone as being this moment, this initiation of this ice crystal formation. It's like this seed or a little bit of dust that things start to build from, that start to elaborate from. Now that seed itself is conditioned by our past history, by our past suffering, by our past beliefs. And so it's that itself creates this quality of Vedana. Because you've probably noticed that, you know, sometimes people like, what's the phrase, there's no accounting for taste, right? So you hear a piece of music and some people say, that's just beautiful. Another group of people say, that's just noise. Right? So pleasant Vedana, unpleasant Vedana, conditioned through our past history. So that's what's interesting, that Vedana isn't like a neutral thing. It actually has this momentum of our own, our history. The good news about that is, because it's conditioned from our past, how we relate to this moment's arising conditions the future arising of it. Okay, so every time I hear the train go by, if I just get really upset about it, I can pretty soon condition myself to be, every time I hear a train, I get really upset. Condition myself to having that negative Vedana. On the other hand, I was at Cloud Mountain one year during the summer, and there's, you know, mosquitoes around, and they tend to really like my blood. I'm very tasty. And so if anyone's getting bit, I'm the one who's getting bit. But I resolved to take this precept of not causing harm very seriously. So I was going to do walking meditation outside all day, you know, every day, several times a day, and not swat or try to kill any mosquitoes. I don't know why I was, now I'm saying it, it seems kind of a little strict. But anyway, it was it was interesting to take that resolve because I would notice the mosquitoes would tend not to bite during the daytime. The morning time and evening they would tend to bite. But the rest of the time they would just kind of go around buzzing around my ear. And because I've had a lifetime of being bit by them, I hear that little high-pitched whine and there's a natural and pleasant Vedana that arises. I mean, it's like my skin crawls. But by not acting on it, and by just hearing it, eventually by the end of the retreat, I could hear the sound without it being connected to the negative Vedana. So it's like this purification of, by through practice, of how what usually has so much reactivity can become unreactive. So becoming aware of this Vedana, this inherent quality of each experience, it's inherent in that if we have an experience, we're going to have some quality of Vedana. The Vedana itself isn't really based on our own past. Becoming aware of it and resting our attention on it starts to interrupt this whole pattern of making this ice crystal. Okay, so the bad news is if it's a pleasant ice crystal, you know, we don't get to experience that pleasant quality. If it's an unpleasant quality, unpleasant Vedana, we don't also don't experience the unpleasant quality. The thing to remember, though, is if you have a pleasant birthing, a pleasant ice crystal that's being created, what happens when that ice crystal melts? You experience suffering, right? So if you've ever had this sense of, I'm doing really good, everyone likes me, and then someone writes a negative critique of you, and you're like, that whole thing collapses. You experience suffering as that sense of self falls away. Sometimes we experience the suffering in the middle of that sense of self because it's really unpleasant. And when it fades, then there's a relief from that. But we're always caught in suffering. You know, it's like a Roth IRA. We pay either up front or when we take our taxes out. I don't know why that came to mind. But so if you start to notice the Vedana, it's like, it can be very simple. Like, okay, this is just an unpleasant experience. Oh, this is unpleasant. As you notice unpleasantness, if you're able to be still, just as I was on the retreat, there's the impulse to act, you know, like to swat those mosquitoes. If I can slow down that impulse, I can just feel that quality of Vedana in itself in a pure way. Same thing if there's a pleasant Vedana. It's like, oh, there's a fantasy or a desire. I see a beautiful sight or smell something. That, oh, this is pleasant. Just to notice, to know that you know this is pleasant. That's a very simple part of this instructions in this foundation, is just to know when a pleasant Vedana is here, know when an unpleasant one is present, know when there's a neutral, neither pleasant or unpleasant. And try to slow down the reactivity of acting from it. That's what the homework points to, is when you're caught in a mind state, is to see if you can slow it down and notice, just acknowledge that this is an unpleasant experience, or this is a pleasant experience. Instead of leaning into the action that naturally wants to come from that, if you can just rest in that quality of unpleasantness. Give yourself a chance to really deepen into the body sense of that. You know, really feel that kind of the urge to want to, like with the mosquitoes, just want to swat them is like almost a visceral urgency. But by being patient with it, it started to unhook. It started to become less and less of a charge. And one of the things I appreciate the most about this sutta is that all these qualities of Vedana, really almost all the foundation, the things we look at in the foundations, are all held without a sense of preference, without a sense of this being good and this being bad, all held equally. And it's like the Buddha says, you know, it doesn't matter what's arising in your experience, a pleasant experience, an unpleasant experience, a neutral. What matters is that you're paying attention to it, that you're attending to it, that you're making contact with it. So the feeling tone, there's a normal day-to-day arising of that. Like every moment's experience will have some associated feeling tone. But it also comes up in meditation too. and some of the categories that the Buddha goes through in this sutta, in this particular foundation, he includes some of the meditative Vedanas, like when there's a higher consciousness or there's a sense of more of the esoteric or mystical states that can come from really deep meditation practices. Often, the kind of the trap is when meditative experiences feel very profound, very mystical, we say, oh, this is it. This is really what I want. And the Buddha says, notice that it's pleasant. Notice the pleasant quality. Instead of saying, oh yeah, that's good, get more and more of those esoteric experiences, he points us back to this inherent quality of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. So it helps us not to get caught in the infatuation or the reactivity. There's a sutta when the Buddha is, I don't know who he's talking to, I think somebody. But they're talking about, okay, if I do these kind of build merit and I die, and do I go to a better lifetime, like a heavenly realm? So it's about heavenly realms. So there's an idea that if we go into the better we do in life through the kind of the merit practice, we get longer and longer rewards, right? But he would say, okay, if you do this, you get into one an eon of a heavenly realm, but it's going to end. It's going to be, it's dukkha too. It's going to eventually become impermanent. And he goes on to 20 eons, 200 eons, and he just keeps expanding it on and on. And normally we would think, oh, I want to, the more I get, the more heaven is better, right? But the Buddha kept saying, but that is dukkha itself. The end of it is always going to end. So if you really are interested in liberation, don't chase after these heavenly realms. Don't chase after these esoteric states, but to see where is that release in this present moment. So it's simply the instructions is to know the Vedana, know the quality of Vedana. Think of it as this kind of flavoring that happens to experience. Experience arises and there's a little flavor of being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. You may notice it more by the impulse that arises with it, pushing it away if it's unpleasant, pulling it close if it's pleasant, spacing out if it's neutral. If you don't know that flavoring, it's likely to create these ice crystals, create this sense of self in an unconscious way. And then we're going to believe that sense of self is who we are. And then it dissolves and there's a quality of suffering, and then we try to create a new crystal, we get caught in this endless round of samsara. So the body is a great help in this, to keep coming back to the present moment, grounding in our physical body. Just as we learn to connect with the sensations and start to free up the identification with them, we start to connect with the Vedana as felt in the body, and it naturally starts to loosen the identification that arises with that also. Now, often we don't notice the Vedana until we have a full-blown ice crystal is formed. It's like that lady from, what's that movie? Frozen. She's gone crazy and made this huge, huge ice palace. So those ice palaces, we're caught in reactivity, we're caught in obsession, infatuation, caught in boredom. These are these really strong mind states that just seem to be so gripping. And this leads us naturally into the third foundation. Now these mind states, sometimes called mind states, consciousness or mind, when we're really caught in a place of reactivity, we have a lot of emotionality, we really believe that's us. This is who I am. I'm really angry right now. I'm really upset. I'm really sad. I'm really happy. It sure feels like us. It seems so convincing. But the thing is, it will change. You know, that the moment we felt so convinced that, okay, I'm an angry person, and then something changes. We don't usually see the process of it melting, and we don't see the process of the next state coming up, but it's there. It's arising. And through being on a retreat, you start to see the process. Or just paying attention in daily life, you can see how it naturally arises and naturally falls away. So with these different mind states, the whole purpose of the sutta is to learn to be mindful of it in a particular way. What I mean by that is there's an aspect of the mind or an aspect of awareness that really holds this mind state and holds it with this non-preference, with a non-judgment, with a non-leaning toward or leaning away, without a value judgment. So it's really not about making it bad or wrong. It's almost this kind of matter-of-fact knowing what is present. It's like if you go out and it's sunny, you know, you just know that it's a sunny day without adding all the ideas of what that means. It's a rainy day without adding all the ideas of what that is. Just like our minds have these different weather systems that go through. If you can just recognize this is the weather system that's present without having to add an extra bit of judgment or valuation, or at least not going down that pathway, then we're getting closer to what the Buddha was talking about. So this sutta is, he doesn't say notice the mind state and get more of the good ones and get less of the bad ones. He doesn't give any guidance around that, which should feel a little disorienting for us, right? Because we're used to like, okay, tell me what the right thing is to do. How do I get an A on the paper? How do I get a good review on my job? Yeah, so we kind of problem solve. How do we get things just perfect? The Buddha is encouraging us to take a very different perspective. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So by relating to the mind state without this preference, we start the deconstruction process. See, the preferencing is inherent in the sense of self. Sometimes it's hard to get a sense of this sense of me, or the sense of self, but you can sometimes see the footprints much easier. Having a preference, being judgmental, judging yourself, being criticized or being critical, these are all expressions of the sense of self. Controlling, resisting, this hunger for something. So we start to observe this weather system in my mind. Because I'm observing it, I'm not so caught in it. To observe it, I have to be a little bit outside it to be able to actually see it, to recognize it. And that means I'm not completely driven by it. So I want to read a few of the pieces from this third foundation. So the Buddha says, a monk or a nun or a practitioner, it's important to realize that when they say bhikkhu, it also means a sincere lay practitioner. Okay? So they know the consciousness with lust as this lust. So you notice, okay, the mind is full of lust, but you recognize it as lust. But you also know the consciousness without lust as without lust. Okay? So with lust, we can look at the infatuation, desire, wanting, that sense of craving that drives us. The Buddha says, does not say to judge that. Do not judge that you're having this, to use Tan Jeff's words, the lustful mind. Right? Not to judge that, but just to notice that that's the state. If you really get that in, there's this freedom that starts to come in. Because we have this, we're constantly judging our experience. This is not the experience I should be having. I should be having this other person's experience or this idea of what I think the other person is having. But if there's this, we start to cultivate this way to hold our experience just as it is without trying to make it something other than it is. In that, there's a deep peace that comes that becomes unshakable. You know, because wherever we go, whatever experience is arising, our consciousness can hold that, our awareness can hold that. Okay, so a lustful mind, consciousness with hate, it has hate in it. This is the state of hate. Or a consciousness without hate, as without hate. Again, he's not saying hate's bad, absence of hate is good. Patterns of irritation, of anger, of fear, anxiety. You know, so try to imagine that or try to work with that, when anxiety comes up, when fear comes up, just to note it as fear. This is the shape of the mind right now. Goes on to ignorance, confusion. You know, if we have mind with ignorance, mind without ignorance. Again, there's not a preferential. It's better to be ignorant or not ignorant. It's just simply to notice what is present. Do you mind not talking back there, please? Thank you. Talks about the shrunken state of the consciousness, the unshrunken state, the distracted mind. I mean, how many people sat down to sit and their mind was a little distracted? How many people judge that distraction? You know, can you imagine that you sense, okay, I'm really distracted. That's just the weather system that's going through the mind in this moment. The highest level consciousness, or the not highest level, being a steady consciousness, a sense of samadhi, or not being steady consciousness. So it starts to, if you really take these and really hear those words, some of the things we hold really value, that, okay, if I have a steady mind, I'm a good meditator. The Buddha is saying, no, it's about noticing how the mind is. Not that the mind is steady or not steady. It's simply noticing that it is the way it is. So that requires us to start to loosen some of the deep constructs of self-judgment, of evaluation, to actually relate to life in a very different way. And he concludes with the freed state, noticing the mind in a freed state, noticing the mind in a non-freed state, in an awakened state and an unawakened state. I mean, it seems like the whole purpose of the practice is to be awakened, but the Buddha is saying, no, it's noticing if the mind's awake or the mind's not awake, liberated or unliberated. So on one level, if we can simply just acknowledge how our minds are, it's a very important step, very helpful. What is the shape of my mind? What's the flavor of that mind state in this moment? The mind with anger, there's an unpleasant vedana that usually has given birth to that. The ice crystal is formed into anger from this unpleasant vedana. You get an email that's a little cutting, and you form this whole vedana, this whole story around it. Usually we get so caught up in the object and the subject, come back to just this quality, okay, I'm really upset right now. Really simply holding it without having to move or act from it. And know it as unpleasant. Say to yourself, this is unpleasant. This is pleasant. If we are able to do that, that means, again, we're not fully inside that state. We're able to observe it. Means we're not completely lost in it. Now, when we are lost in it, in those states, we don't see it as being outside of ourselves. You know, I am really caught in this quality of being reactive, being angry. This is who I am. And more really, we've built this ice crystal, it really biases how we interpret life. We hear something and that person's criticizing me or that person's judging me. It really colors everything because we've taken birth within it and we're living from that perspective. So practice is just to see it as a mind state, just to see it as a mind state, that it's not inherently who we are. You know, one of the jobs that Tweri and I have as guiding teachers, you know, in this interim role, and we have new board members come on, we meet with them and we go through some of the board member principles. These principles are designed to help board members see their service on the board as Dharma practice, right? To see it as Dharma practice. So there's principles and there's also practices. One of the principles is to be willing to be influenced, to be willing to be influenced. So this is a paradox that we see, that we want each member to bring forth their ideas, their passion, and how they view the situation. So it enriches the dialogue, helps us make better decisions as a board. And yet we also want the board members to have this quality of seeing their their opinions are just a mind state too, to not to be so invested that they're not willing to hear anyone else's opinions, to not be willing to be influenced. And so if we really hold ourselves on one side of righteousness, of being the clear person, everyone else doesn't know what they're talking about, we're not being willing to be influenced. If we're willing to be influenced, to be really listened, to really take someone else in, we start to loosen this investment in this mind state, in this who we take ourselves to be. Because when we get invested, you know, our minds, it's very difficult to work with others when there's a conflict. And on the board, it's hard to continue this sense of stewardship of the organization. The board is working very well together. I just bring this up because we just met with someone last week and just it was interesting talking about it and how that sense of being willing to be influenced is such a Dharma principle. It really ties into this not believing our mind states as being absolutely true. Now the body continues to be a refuge. Right? When we find ourselves in a very strong state of mind, coming back to what does the body feel like in this moment? Just that simple question. Where is this reactivity, this anger felt like in the body? And just not with a sense of agenda, like I want to pay attention in order to get rid of my anger or get rid of my fear or get rid of my, I guess you don't want to get rid of your joy, but you know, there's that sense of just noticing where is it connected in the body. That starts to ground us in the present moment. Now often we say, what is meditation? It doesn't matter what we're being mindful of. Okay, so there's a whole myriad of objects we can be attentive to. It's the quality of the attention that matters, the quality of connecting with that moment's experience. So we see this very clearly in the second and third foundations. The Buddha is not saying that one way is better, one mind state is better. It's really this quality of noticing it. It's not saying notice when the mind has an aversion and then get rid of that aversion. That's bad. He's not saying notice when the mind is concentrated and get more of that. So that it should make your head scratch a little bit, like, because it throws into question our very strategies that we bring into meditation. You know, let me figure out what's the right way to do it, and then I'm just going to make myself do it. So at the beginning, that's what we have to start with. But eventually, hopefully fairly soon, we start to question that strategy in itself, the strategy of trying to make our minds look a certain way, to have a certain experience. And I really love this aspect from the sutta, because we have such strong judgment about how our mind's content, how it should look or shouldn't look. So the Buddha's saying it's not that at all. It's really this noticing. So this brings a strong quality flavor of non-duality. Non-duality is, you can hear it in some of the early suttas. And non-duality means, if you look at what duality means, it's usually this good, bad, self, other, you know, sense of separation. We look out and we see two, or 100, or whatever it might be. Non-duality starts to see that everything is interconnected, that there's no sense of separation between self and other, between good and bad. And that should create a little bit of dissonance in the normal way we think. Because our normal way of thinking is inherently dualistic. We go out labeling self and other, right, good and bad. So this asks us to actually interrupt that normal way, not to preload that, but to come with a different way of relating to this moment's experience. It really points toward this profound non-preferential, non-judgmental quality of mindfulness. It's like the space in this room. It doesn't care if it touches this person versus that person. It doesn't care, you know, what your age is, your gender, your orientation, your race. Any way we define ourselves, all the myriad ways we define ourselves, it doesn't care. It touches all completely equally. completely equally. One mind state is not better than another from this perspective. One Vedana is not better than another. So this is the quality of awareness that starts to hold things, holds what's present without identification of I or me or mine. See, that sense of preferencing, that sense of duality, that's really a process of identification, a process of taking self. When I say this is, even the sense of separation, okay, there's going from, even from good to bad, I like it or don't like it, just a sense that these are different. From that mind state, there is a sense of preferencing. Because if you like something or don't like it, it assumes there's a sense of me with that, who is liking that, who is wanting that. It's really embedded into the preference that there is a sense of self. Another way to say this is it means dropping the middleman. Okay, so middleman. So often there's a company who manufactures something, there's another company who repackages it and then sells it to us. Sometimes there's multiple stages along this pathway. Right. So this practice is learning about trying to buy directly. Because usually what happens is an experience arises in our consciousness and we quickly repackage it. We package it, we put a Vedana on it, we put a sense of reactivity, I like it or don't like it, we create this whole story around it. This is a sense of repackaging. Even the sense of I'm having this experience is a form of that repackaging. So we learn to relate to our breath, for example, very simply, just this breath. I think a helpful way to do this, we can do it right now as you're listening. We feel our breath in the confines of our body. Okay, here's the body breathing and breathing out. Now let the confines go, so there's this sense of the breath filling the whole room. It's almost as if the space in the room is breathing. By letting the awareness expand like this, we start to loosen the confines of who we are, the confines of the body. Suzuki Roshi had a very nice analogy that he talked about if you had a wild stallion and you put it in a small corral and it has, you know, it's really angry, has lots of energy, it's going to kick and buck and cause lots of damage to the stall and to itself. You take that same horse and put it out in an open meadow where it can run around freely, it naturally starts to quiet down. Right? So when we have a mind state, and we put judgment on top of it, we're like putting that horse into a small corral. It gets tighter and tighter. But if we allow that state to be held in a much more spacious way, and literally, I think visualizing this, like the space in the room holding it. So the anger, the fear, the joy is held in the whole space of the room, beyond the confines of the body, behind the confines of the mind, then it's held in a very different way. It's not being held through our self-identification. It's being held by the spaciousness. The same quality with Vedana. And you notice this quality being pleasant or unpleasant. It's like noticing a scent in the room. There's a little jasmine or a little bit of rosemary or sage. Letting that expand so the whole room is feeling it. So next time you feel this mind state arise, you know, notice it clearly. What is present? Okay, I know that this is an unpleasant experience. I know that my mind has this angry quality. And then let that fill the room. Not like you're yelling and screaming, but just letting the confines, letting it feel like the whole room is holding that experience. And you can see that there's a softening to it. This is this abiding in the moment, free of craving and aversion. This is the sense of dropping the middleman, the process of self-referencing, that this is me. And just to go back to conclude with Dogen's famous statement, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this non-trace continues endlessly. So we can just sit quietly for a moment or two. And as we sit, just fully knowing what is the state of your mind in this moment, with absolutely no judgment, no preference, just this clear knowing of it. And allow that knowing to expand so it's the whole room is holding this mind state. And then releasing fully, allowing it to go where it will, to fade, to deepen, as the stillness, the space of the room that holds all experience, all sensation, all vedana, all mind states. All right, thank you for your kind attention. And so we have some time for any comments or questions or observations. Yes.
A couple of questions. One, you talked about thought as one of the five senses.
Yes.
Does that become six, I guess?
Sure, so one question is, talking about the thought as one of the five senses. Yes, so there's, I probably misspoke, that's six senses from a Buddhist perspective, from what the Buddha taught.
And the other thing is, talking about, you know, observing the state and not being lost in it, and I wonder if doing that fully sometimes results in more passiveness than more passiveness in general, in any activity or in even advocating for something?
So the question is, when we relate to a state, it kind of sends a spaciousness to it, does that lead to more of a quality of passiveness in life, you know, through different expressions of that? And it's a good question, and it's a very common question. It's kind of this interplay between the kind of contemplative abiding with the present moment, and then, you know, how do I live my life? How do I actually engage with life, and, you know, have effective change in the world? You know, take care of what needs to be taken care of, because it does seem like it's paradoxical. Seem like they're contrary to each other. What I would tend to say is that we're much more practiced at being reactive, you know, getting out there and doing things. We tend to be much less practiced in noticing with the shape that our mind is forming, right? So we tend to go around with these ice crystals, to use that analogy, and we don't quite realize that that's really what's happened, and then we're acting from that quality of reactivity. Now, if we're able to start to notice that and start to really, like with my example of the mosquitoes, all right? So at first I had no control, basically. Hear this, the sound, and I wanted to do something with it right away. By kind of going through this, pushing myself not to act on it, to hold it, I started to unhook my reactivity. And then I could find that when the sound arose, I was able to be much more responsive. Okay, now I have a choice of, okay, gently moving this or doing something that's not so driven by reactivity. And so that's why practicing in this way, it's like this present moment, learning how to really clean up how we act with it. How do we respond to it? By doing that, we open up actually much more effective action because it's not tainted by our reactivity. Because typically when we're reactive, we have a very narrow response, or narrow repertoire, I should say. Right? Because it's based on our conditioning. We're kind of going from this point to this point because we've always done that. But by learning to be open to that, by not doing anything with it, then this whole field of options start to open up. So then the same situation happens. Like, let's say there's something at work that we need to say. We really hold, okay, I feel upset, I'm feeling nervous about this, I hold this mind state, and then I'm able to be much more effective. Because when I'm able to hold my own reaction, you can hold someone else's reaction. Right? So I can hear, okay, I hear that you're upset, I hear that you're angry. And so it actually, I've found that it really transforms my ability to be in the world, to be effective in the world. So it seems like a paradox, but it's like learning how to relate to life in a very different way, and then it comes back into relating to life in a very skillful way. Thank you for the question. Yes, Ryan. Sure. Right. Okay, so the question is, if you look at the sutta, there's different qualities of worldly and unworldly, supreme or unsurpassed and surpassed, and those kind of qualities. And so what I think what those mean, they're really talking about some of the deeper qualities of meditation, like some of the concentration or trance states, some of the jhana states. There's that language, I think, is pointing toward that so a trance state or a jhana state is like we just focus on this one thing to exclusion everything else. So it's very different than a vipassana approach, even though it's part of the larger tradition. It's like this one point of focus. As we do that over and over and over again for days and weeks and months, we start to change, a mental state starts to arise, a different state of consciousness arises. So I think that's what they mean by the otherworldly or that suppressed. Okay. I think in this sutta, there's a warning that, okay, even though it feels really cool or really interesting, it's more important to notice the quality of Vedana. Because if we don't notice the quality of Vedana, we subtly get caught in wanting to have more and more of those states. We think that state of being really, feels really esoteric, it feels really mystical, that's what I want more of. We miss the part that this is pleasant. And from that pleasant point, we make this ice crystal of wanting more of it. When we want more of it, we're caught in the cycle of suffering. Because eventually that's going to fade away. It's going to end. And then we have to go back again and again on retreats. And so that's kind of the difference perhaps between... So there's many benefits for practicing jhana states. The insight practice is really what has this liberating quality. Yeah, so the jhana states often are seen as a way to help us have deeper insights. But there's ways to, like Rodney really is a proponent of practicing insight more in a purely direct way. Okay, does that help?
Yeah.
Lauren, did you have a question?
I just tried to
Yes.
To some degree, it was really subtle, and I wasn't sure whether I was really feeling that or not. But when you suggested that again, the same thing happened.
Okay. I mean, you described it very well. So the comment was that the instructions to focus not on an object or the details of life, the sense of what's like the breath, for example, versus focusing on the space, how by doing that there's a subtle quality of peace and well-being that arises with that. And that heard that from another teacher too. And is there a question in that, or you want me just to talk more about that?
I've been trying to see I've been thinking of the no self, because it's really hard for me to conceive of that. I keep finding myself where I go, there I am. But there was something that when I was suggested to be aware of the space,
yes,
it seemed to help me have less of myself.
Yes. Okay, so that's, thank you. So when she tries to look at the sense of self, it's like wherever she looks, there's a sense of self that's popping up. But looking at the sense of space, it seemed like that quieted down. There's a sense of releasing of that. And that's really why that kind of instruction is helpful at times, is because when we go to sit down and meditate, I go down and attend to my breath. Just by doing that, we've subtly kind of taken up this perspective that I am going to do something. I am looking out, I'm looking in at something. So we've already kind of set up the construct that there's already a duality. It's inherent in the way that we're looking. And so, not to say that can be very helpful at first, because that's what we have to start with. I'm going to really tune into my breath. I'm going to really connect with it, the quality of me doing it. And yet that at the same time is limiting, especially if we want to understand that sense of self. Because we start to notice that any kind of movement, any sense of having a stance, a sense of relationship to it, a sense of liking it or disliking, that's inherently a quality of sense of self. So for me to relate to the experience without that, things get very, very still. It's like this paradox of being very still, but at the same time very alive in the same moment. So by having this expanding out the boundaries of you, not feeling like it's not like you doing it, but it's like the whole room is holding this experience. It starts to expand out that sense of self. It stretches it out. And so what often happens is that we start off really focusing on the sense of self. Okay? And then we say, okay, what's this non-self? And we get a taste of that, and we really go after that. And we start getting experiences of non-self. And then our subtle parts of self say, I want more of that non-self. All right, I want to get more of that. And so the next phase is just, as this sutta really elegantly keeps coming back again, self or non-self, just to notice it. There's something that holds both of those that's even beyond that. Okay, so you get this flavor, you get this orientation of what does it feel like to have this very expansive consciousness. But when we start to turn into, I like that, I want more of that, okay, that's that vedana that makes this whole ice crystal. That's why it gets so sneaky. But the Buddha, it really was wise to really say, concentrated or unconcentrated, worldly or unworldly, free mind or unfreed. It's really, he lays it out there. And so that becomes the koan, that okay, you start to notice that sense of expansion and how there's a deep peace. There's like a lack of friction to the moment. And then when something arises, can that also be completely held in both the reality that's here, but then also that there's no friction with it? So they both are held completely at the same time. Okay, thank you, Lauren. Yes. Through your what?
Through bias.
Bias, yeah.
So, for example, let's just say that there's a leader in the United States who's anti-something.
Just to say, yeah. hypothetically. Right. Yeah, it's very connected to that one.
Passive,
yeah.
I mean, is reactivity when you make it by yourself? Is that what that means? Is that what the Dharma means about reactivity?
Yeah.
It's all about you? Because otherwise emotions seem a little bit, and how do you sort that out?
Okay, so let me see if I can see if I got your point. So. And it connects with that earlier point, the first question, that there's a world leader or a potential world leader that's creating lots of reaction. You're feeling really angry, feeling scared, worried about it. Is what the Buddha is saying like, okay, I should just sit in the middle of that and just let that happen and not just kind of hold my reaction and not do anything about it? And I think it really is. It goes back to this, let me answer it from a kind of a slightly different thing. So one of my friends is pro-gun, okay, and she always leaves out these pro-gun magazines in my waiting room and I take them away. But sometimes I look at some of the articles and just to kind of see the perspective. And to hold, okay, this perspective is very opposite of what my perspective is. But because there's this reaction that holds it as opposite, that this is not true, this is can't be, I'm creating this sense of separation from that experience, from that person. Another example is I was working with a couple people. One person was a Tea Party person. And he's saying, I'm really worried about if this other side gets into office, what's gonna happen to our children? The next person was very liberal. And they said the exact same thing. I'm really worried what's going to happen to our children. And so, because my role in those relationships wasn't to interject my judgment or my opinion, but just to listen to them, I was automatically hearing it. And by doing that, I was able to connect with this deeper common fear, this desire to have children have a good world to go into. Completely different ideas of what that would look like. But by connecting with my own reactivity and seeing, okay, this other person has their own perspective, that allows me to both hold my reactivity, but be much more able to connect. Because if you go and say to the other party, okay, you're wrong, you're just an idiot, da, 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 it creates a sense of tension, right? But is there a way that you can show up, connect with this person, still hold your own integrity, really know clearly, you become actually more and more clear what's right? By clearing up your reactivity and being able to really connect with yourself, your heart becomes very aligned with what you know is true. So it becomes actually much, you're not going to get flustered because you know it's true. But at the same time, you're much more able to connect with this other side. Right? Because if we just keep going, you know, pushing each other, we just have this endless war. You know, you're right, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. But when you connect with what's the commonality, then there's a hope for actual change.
Mm-hmm. Barriers. I mean, sometimes I think that there is right and wrong.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there certainly is. I guess what I'm saying is that don't get distracted by what they say, with missing really what's the heart of what they're talking about. So you connect with the heart of that. Yeah, the extremes of what they say. That yeah, of course you're not going to allow that. You're going to fight against that. You're going to protect that group of people. You know, protect, not let a wall be built, right? Right, so there's that direct action. You know, of course that's not, I'm gonna do everything I can to stop that from happening. But by the next step is then you connect with the perspective of fear that's driving that. The sense of being disempowered, the sense of, you know, all those kind of deeper qualities. So it's kind of paradoxical that you can say, no, we're not gonna do that. But you can, it's like if you have a kid, you have a child, the child may really want to stay up late, but you know it's not good for them, so you're going to say no, we're going to go to bed. But you connect with them emotionally. You connect with what's going on. Right? So you can hold this line that this is the line that we're holding, and I'm going to still connect with you as a human being. I mean, really, the point of it is to end suffering. Right? Because if we go into it with a quality of not seeing our reactivity, we're causing more and more suffering for ourselves. Right? So that's really the heart of it, and to alleviate suffering in others. And what that looks like can be very different for you, for me, for anyone else in there. Yeah, so it's really connecting with that in a deep way. Yeah, these are great questions. You know, how does the practice really show up in life? And they often seem very paradoxical. But I think if you really go into this, okay, I just want to understand my own reactivity, you'll find by understanding your own reactivity, it will transform how you are in the world. You won't be like, oh, it's okay if they deport every Muslim. That's okay. It's just like for your own body, you won't. You realize, okay, it's not okay for me to get harmed or for me to be abused. You become very clear about that. Yeah, it actually is very empowering. You should become much more powerful in your actions, but still in a kind way. Yeah. So I appreciate your energy behind that. So just use it as a koan. How can I really understand my own reactivity and at the same time really do what I think is right in the world? Yeah, they're not contradictory, they're not exclusive by any means. You're welcome. Anyone else out there? Any other questions? Okay. Okay, thank you for your kind attention.